welcome back, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. This is Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik, and the website is redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. Today we have Walter Block with us. He earned his PhD in economics at Columbia University. He is an author, editor, and co-editor of many books, which include Defending the Undefendable, Lexicon of Economic Thought, Rent Control, Myths and Realities, Discrimination, Affirmative Action, and Equal Opportunity, and also Privatization of Roads and Highways, and many more titles. Dr. Block has written more than 500 articles for various non-referred journals, magazines, and newspapers, and is a contributor to such journals as the Review of Austrian Economics, Journal of Libertarian Studies, the Journal of Labor Economics, Cultural Dynamics, and others. He is currently professor of economics at Loyola University, New Orleans, and senior fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Thank you for coming on, Walter. We appreciate you taking some time off your busy schedule talking with us today. Really looking forward to this. Welcome to the program.
It's good to be with you. Thank you for having me.
You bet. We have a lot of interesting topics we'd like to talk with you about today, introducing some nuance, I think, to our audience, and hopefully they are familiar, of course, with some of this already. We've talked a little bit about anarchism in the past, and we're going to connect this into some of the topics. But if we were to explain or define, I guess, your philosophy, your viewpoint, Walter, first to our audience, where you're coming from, where would we begin? Would we say that you're an anarcho-capitalist, a libertarian, a proponent of Austrian economics, maybe all of them?
Yes, all of the above. Anarchism, Austrian economics, libertarianism. I strive to do justice to all of them.
Very good. So, anarcho-capitalist, for those who don't know, define that for us.
Well, the capitalist part just means that people should be free to own property, and the way I justify it, I'm a follower of Murray Rothbard on this and on many other things, is first is the homesteading. You have to get unowned pieces of land, a virgin territory, and you get them by mixing your labor with them. And then you get to own a tree or a forest or a farm or whatever. And then any other legitimate title transfer, such as voluntary title transfer, such as a trade or gifts or gambling or what have you. So if I clear a forest and make a corn and you domesticate a cow and get milk, you own the milk, I own the corn, and then we trade or have a barter, and now I own the milk even though I didn't produce it, and you own the corn even though you didn't produce it. And that's property rights in a nutshell. The other part of libertarianism is the non-aggression principle, namely all our interaction between you and me and us and everyone else should be voluntary and consensual. Nobody should grab anything. Nobody should engage in murder or rape or theft or anything like that. And that would be the ideal libertarian society. So that's the capitalist or the libertarian part. Well, how do you get into anarchism? Well, anarchism says, and by the way, people confuse anarchism. They think that it means, you know, bombing innocent people or some crazy.
Right.
That's not at all what we mean by it. Etymologically, archism is unjustified control of one person by another, such as slavery or kidnapping. And the prefix "an" just means against. So anarchists are against archy, and archy is the violation of the non-aggression principle. So we favor the non-aggression principle, and we say that the government violates it because it taxes us, it orders us around, and we didn't agree to it. If we had agreed to the government, if we had agreed to have a nanny, as in, say, a voluntary sadomasochism, like if you're the sadist and I'm a masochist and you whip me, you know, the joke about that is the masochist says to the sadist, "Whip me," and the sadist says, "No." I don't know if you get the joke, but the point is that, yeah. Voluntary sadomasochism between consenting adults is legitimate because there's agreement. But we didn't agree to have the government of Sweden or the United States or Canada engage in sadistic activities with regard to us, namely taxing us and regulating us, telling us that we must register for the draft, that we can't use marijuana or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So the anarchist part is just that all institutions, all people, whether they call themselves government or not, should adhere to the non-aggression principle and live peaceably. Now, I mean, if you ask most people on the street, even in Sweden, do you agree in initiating violence against innocent people? They're going to say, no, of course not. We're not murderers. We're not rapists. I mean, only 0.1% of the population is like that, thank God. But the average person, when you say, well, what about the government? Don't they violate it? All of a sudden, their brains go out the window or through their ears.
Yep.
And they don't make the connection that the government is a violator of the non-aggression principle. So that's Austrian. That is rather libertarianism and anarchism. The Austrianism follows from Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard, and it's a different kind of economics. It's not an economics based on empirical, a neoclassical or Marxist. It's rather based on just pure logic. If you want, I can go into that for a bit, but I think that this segment is more toward the libertarian than the Austrian, but if I'm mistaken, I can go on for a few minutes about that.
Well, explain it a bit, so that way people know, and we can return to it later if we want to talk more about that.
Okay. A minute or two on Austrian economics?
Sure. Go ahead.
Okay. Austrian economics, by the way, just as anarchism has nothing to do with mad bombing, Austrian economics has very little to do with the country Austria. It's not the economics of Austria. It's rather the fact that the school of economics, Austrian economics, came about through Menger and Bomberg and Hayek and Mises, all of whom happened to live in Austria. Very similar to the Chicago School of Economics. It's got very little or nothing to do with the economics of the city of Chicago. It's just that Friedman and Becker and Stigler are all at the University of Chicago, so that's why they call it Chicago economics. So what then is Austrian economics? It's the idea that economics is not an empirical science. It's not a branch of physics. It's you don't create hypotheses and then test them. Rather, it's a branch of logic. It starts with basic premises such as human action, and human action, namely human beings have purposes and act, can't be denied because the very denial of it is a human action. So we start from that as our premise. And we deduce from that, given certain assumptions like labor is a scarce resource and we live in a world of scarcity, and we do deduce certain economic laws, whereas the mainstream doesn't have economic laws. What they have is hypotheses which are tested and provisionally accepted unless they're refuted by empirical econometric testing, which we don't go along with. For example, take the claim that trade is mutually beneficial in the ex ante sense. So before I was talking about trading my corn with your milk. And my claim as an Austrian economist is that there's a law that says that if we both agree to make that trade, then I must value the milk more than the corn, and you must value the corn more than the milk. Notice we're not testing this. This is not a hypothesis. If you understand the English language, you know that the statement that I just made is necessarily true. Whereas the mainstream, the logical positivist, would say, well, you know, you're just being cultish. There's no such thing as law. Milton Friedman once attacked Austrian economics by saying, well, suppose two Austrian economists disagree. They have to get into a fight. And, you know, that's silly because if two logicians disagree, they don't have to get into a fight. They just go back to the basic premises and check their premises, as Ayn Rand would say.
Yeah.
So that's a sort of a quick and dirty, very much of an introduction to what Austrian economics is. And the two are very different. Austrian economics, like all economics, is an attempt to understand and explain economic reality. So it's a positive science, if you want to put it that way, whereas libertarianism is normative. It's a claim as to what's right, what's just, what's appropriate, what's fair, what's moral, whereas Austrian economics doesn't get into that. It just tries to understand what causes what.
Very good. Thanks for that little introduction and, of course, the definition of some of those terms. We'll return to some of these points a bit later and talk more about this. There's so many questions to follow on from this, of course. But I've been getting into some of Murray Rothbard's writing lately and coming out of the environment of Sweden, it's tremendously refreshing to read about some of these ideas. Now, did you know Murray when he was alive? I think he passed away in 95, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes, he passed away in 1995. I met him in 1965 or 6, I forget. and I've been a friend and admirer of his for many, many years. He's the person who affected me the most in every way, as an economist, as a libertarian, as a person, as a human being. When I'm not sure what to do, I sometimes try to channel Murray and ask what would he do in these circumstances, and try to do something similar. He's my mentor, my guru, my friend. I think the world of him. I think he's just a magnificent person. I think he's the second best economist who ever lived, second to Mises. And I think he is the best, bar no one, libertarian theoretician.
How would you define some of Murray's work to someone who's never heard about them before? Is it an easy way to kind of encapsulate his ideas?
Yes. Murray was an anarchist libertarian and an Austrian economist, and I've covered that a bit. He was also a historian. I follow Murray in libertarianism and the Austrianism, but he it was sort of a Renaissance man. Like, he was really an expert in five or six other fields. He made original contributions to history. He made original contributions to philosophy. He was a sociologist. His sociology of the Ayn Rand cult is something you don't want to miss. He made contributions to art criticism, movie criticism. He was just a Renaissance man. I think there must have been five Murray Rothbards, because he wrote so much. One person couldn't write that much. I once had an interesting experience with him. When I first started writing, I would keep track of how many words I would write in a day. And if I would write, 5 pages of 300 words or 1,500 words, I would consider, I'd give myself a little pat on the back. And then every once in a while I'd get up to 10 pages, and that was really an excellent day. But one day I got up really early, and I stayed up very, very late, and I did something like 23 pages of writing. So I was a young pup, and I called Murray, and I said, how many pages can you write in a day? And I said, wah, wah. I'm now imitating Murray, and who keeps track? That's what he said after I kept pushing him. And finally I said, I got him to say, well, how many words do you write in an hour? And he said, 7 pages per hour, something like that. In other words, it was almost 100 words per minute. I think a good typist can do 100 words a minute, and he did something like 50 words a minute. And at that rate, it's no wonder you don't really need 5 Murray Rothbards. And he never, anything he publishes, pretty much the first version of it, very little changes. Whereas, when I publish, it's the fifth try at it, or the fifth revision, or the tenth revision, or the 20th revision. So Murray was sort of a guidelight to my life, and to introduce him to new people. He was the foremost libertarian theoretician and a foremost Austrian economist.
Very good. Yeah, some of the writing is really excellent. Some great ideas in there, and we'll get into this a little bit more as we go here, of course. It just seems that some people are... Yeah, go ahead.
Let me interrupt you and say that there's a buddy of mine, Wendy McElroy. I don't agree with her on everything, but she wrote a magnificent thing about Murray. Mm-hmm. And what she said is that he was the only person who combined Austrian economics and libertarian theory with anti-war analysis. You see, most libertarians are sort of rightish, and most economists are rightish, but many rightists are pro-war. And what Murray did is combine this sort of brew, which the person who now makes it most famous is Ron Paul, because a lot of people ask about Murray and Ron Paul. Well, if you're for free enterprise, you must be for imperialism, or you must be for warmongering. And Murray, I think, was the first, before Ron Paul, to make it clear that just because you favored free enterprise and just because you favored liberty domestically in the economy doesn't mean you have to be a fascist in foreign policy. And yet that's sort of the Buckley type or Ayn Rand attitude.
Well, that's pretty amazing, actually, how that has gone mixed up, or rather how people have been boxed in by these preset ideologies without kind of, from my point of view, thinking them through, if you will. I mean, I know Murray was opposed to the aggressive foreign policy that we see from the United States today and many other countries as well, but also on an individual level, that it's not about, violating anyone else's rights or getting in the way in that way. But How is it that this has come about, do you think, in terms of the United States, if we talk about that historically a little bit, of how this has developed? And today, of course, a bigger misconception, just as you say, is that the U.S., who has been, you know, a capitalist nation, this is what it brings, kind of thing. It brings an aggressive foreign policy, and it's just completely mixed up.
Yeah, well, I think Ayn Rand and William Buckley are responsible to some degree for that. The people in South America who have been victimized by U.S. imperialism somehow mistake this, and they think that, well, that's what capitalism is. And since that's what capitalism is, and capitalism for them means killing innocent people, well, then they're against capitalism, and they go to socialism or fascism or something. I guess socialism.
Yeah.
But I think it's incumbent upon we, Murray's heirs, intellectual heirs, to make it clear that there is no logical incompatibility, there's no inconsistency between wanting freedom domestically and freedom in foreign policy, whereas the mainstream, you know, they see it as sort of left and right, that if you're like the New York Times view, that if you're for the left, well, then you can't be for freedom domestically, but you have to be for freedom, civil liberties, and foreign policy. I think the libertarian view that we should have freedom in all three arenas of political economy, namely personal liberties, economics, and foreign policy, that's the only consistent position. And the other people who are inconsistent, like the ACLU, might be pretty good on personal liberties, but horrible on economics.
Yeah, that's right. So if we look at this from the point of view of the political spectrum, I mean, and that's not only true in the U.S., I think. I mean, same thing is happening in well, we don't have that much ratio, of course, on the political spectrum in Sweden, but we still have this kind of the blocks emerging from, you know, seven popular parties. But it's really just two factions, the left and the, you know, supposedly right when it comes to Sweden, but left and right in the U.S. There must be a way out of that, of course. There must be a third, fourth option that just kind of shatters these illusions, right?
Yes, well, I think the Libertarian Party has been using this what do you call it? Chart, the Nolan chart, to indicate that left and right are not incompatible in this regard. Although the Nolan chart is weak because it only has civil liberties and economics, it doesn't have foreign policy. But Ron Paul was told by many people, you know, we go along with your gold standard, we go along with your getting rid of the Fed, we go along with the, getting rid of rent control or minimum wage or unions or whatever, and we also favor personal liberties, but will you shut up about the war, you know?
Really, yeah.
Just drop that and you can become president. And Ron Paul would say, but look, it's all part of one big liberty, sphere. And all the parts are interconnected with each other. And the people who are logically inconsistent are not the libertarians who favor freedom in all three realms, but rather the left or the right who favor freedom in only one or two realms. And even there, not as much as they should.
Yeah. That's right. Why don't we talk a little bit more about how, you know, with government's position here as basically having, monopoly on violence as being a violator in terms of our rights and imposing their will on us and everything else. I mean, there might be people out there. We've talked about this in the past with some people as well on the program, of course, but they might be in a very uncertain position where they don't really understand. But wait a minute, are you suggesting that we just remove government altogether? And, you know, again, we're falling into this category of, all right, everything would just collapse, everything would just, you know, falter and everything else. So maybe we can just detail a little bit about this and from your point of view as well, Walter, in terms of what government actually does to us, at this point in time.
Yes, well, first let me say I don't think government has a monopoly of violence. I just think they are the overwhelming number of people that commit violence. There is such a thing as private violence, you know, rapists and murderers and kidnappers, and I would say they're responsible for, I don't know, 1% of the violence and government for 99% of the violence. There's this guy, Rummel, I forget his first name, R.J. Rummel, who has done an analysis of deaths.
Democide, yeah.
Democide, death by government, and I think what he says is that in the last century, the 20th century, governments killed 173 million people, not in wars, just their own people, just domestic killing, and if you add up the number of deaths due to government wars, you get much more gigantic numbers, and, you know, compared to that, some murderer or rapist or, you know, I mean, is responsible for a minuscule amount of it. I mean, you know, lately we've been having these problems in Connecticut and Denver and elsewhere where you get some mad gunman who comes in and shoots 25 people. Or in Norway, there was this case, you know more about that than I, where some mad crazy man shot 100 people.
Brevik, yeah.
Now, that's horrible, and, you know, I don't want anyone to think that I favor that. I mean,
of course not.
But this is one millionth of a percent or one-tenth of a percent of what government does. So when people think, you know, we get rid of government and we don't have any police and we don't have any armies, and they think that these murderer types are going to come around and start shooting everybody. But in actual point of fact, as I say, government is responsible for much more deaths. And the idea here is that if government doesn't do it, it can't get done is a fallacy, because we do have private alternatives to all of these things. Let's say take police, first of all, police. In the United States, I don't know what it is in other countries, but there are more private policemen than there are government policemen. I live in New Orleans, and we have this park called Audubon Park, which is a lovely park, many, many acres. And yet, if you go there in midnight, you're in danger. Whereas if you go to Disney World, which is a private park, you're not really in much danger at all, because they have private policemen. You see, if somebody gets murdered in Audubon Park, does the mayor of Audubon Park lose money? Does the commissioner of parks of New Orleans lose money? No. Whereas if somebody gets murdered or raped in Disney World or Disneyland or any of those private parks, that would be a horror. So what they do is, you know, they have cameras all over the place, and they have people in duck uniforms and mouse uniforms, and if you ask obstreperously, they'll say, "Come with me, sir," and, you know, these ducks and mice are packing heat. So I think that the idea that if it weren't for government, we'd live in a chaotic world, there'd be chaos, there'd be rampant murder and rape and stuff like that, is nonsense. Rather, the amount of murder and rape and craziness that we have going on is due to government. For example, take the law on drugs. We have laws in the United States against marijuana, cocaine, heroin, and a lot of people are killed over battles over turf and poisoned by improper drugs, poisonous drugs. If the government would just stop that, a lot of lives would be saved, and a lot of people wouldn't be in jail for, you know, the victimless crime of smoking or buying or selling heroin or marijuana. It's very similar with alcohol. During the Prohibition period in the United States, we had mayhem. A lot of Italian Americans were killing each other over alcohol, and people were dying from bathtub gin. And then we legalized it, thank goodness, and all those deaths went away. And it would be the same with drugs. So here are cases of so-called private people committing crimes and government putting them in jail, and you get the idea that, well, government is the savior, government is the beneficiary. But in actual point of fact, it's government that's creating this havoc. And if we had less government or no government, in my view, we'd be much better off. Let me just take one more example. One of my recent books is on privatizing the highways, roads, and streets. In the United States, over the last 10 years, some 40,000 people have died as a result of highway fatalities. And in my view, this is due to socialist government roads. And if we had private roads and road owners were competing with each other as to how to move people better, more efficiently, and more safely, we'd have many, many fewer deaths. And yet nobody attributes these deaths to the government. And, you know, 40,000 people dying is a lot more than die from this gun violence, where Obama's going berserk and trying to ban guns and get government to, you know, stop people from having guns. So here's another example where everyone thinks that if you didn't have government, you wouldn't have police, you wouldn't have roads, you wouldn't have health, you wouldn't have this or that. The point is that the free enterprise system can supply and has supplied every last thing that the government ever supplied, and it did it much better, much cheaper, much more safely. So this fear of the absence of government, I think, is highly problematic, and people ought to rethink that.
Well, indeed. I think Murray listened to one of his talks, or if it was from one of the books on YouTube, I think it was, he made the point that if crime is high in a park, let's say, the solution that the government offers is that they enforce a curfew, and then the people who visit the park after hours, they are the ones who are penalized instead of, you know, solving the issue of high crime in the park, which is a kind of interesting way of doing it. And that was a good analogy overall for how government usually handles the problem.
Yes, it's the same thing with the post office. During Christmas, people mail a lot of letters. So what does the government do? It says, well, don't mail letters during Christmas. It says, you know, mail them in November or mail them in October. Whereas other people do other things during Christmas besides mail letters. They go to hotels. They go to restaurants. Do the restaurants and the hotels tell them not to come? No. What they do is they put on a second shift or a third shift or whatever it is, or the customer is always right in the private sector, whereas the government, they just say, well, you know, don't mail during Christmas or don't come out to the park or whatever it is.
Well, that's right. And it seems like despite all the atrocities of socialism that we've seen historically, the people are still drawn to it. Okay, there might be a new language that it's wrapped, it's in new terminology and everything else, but the general outline of it remains the same. Why do you think that people are drawn to this as a political option?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm not really against socialism or collectivism, because there are voluntary ways of doing that. For example, the kibbutz, the monastery, the collective farm or whatever. So if people want to do that on a voluntary basis, God bless them, that's fine with
sure.
me.
Yeah.
The problem is coercive socialism, coercive collectivism, where people are forced into these things. My analysis of why we have this is based on sociobiology. So let me explain a little bit of what sociobiology is. What sociobiology is a theory, and this is not Austrian economics, so it's not a law, it's just a theory, a hypothesis, that says that we are the way we are nowadays because of what it took to survive and leave progeny a million years ago or 100,000 years ago or whenever we were in the caves or the trees. So, for example, suppose there were two tribes or two sects or two groups, each with the same opposable thumb, the same physical power, the same brain power. Only one group, when a baby cried, nobody really cared much. And our group, when a baby cried, you got really upset and you tried to help the baby. Well, that other society would tend to not leave much progeny to the next generation because, this is an obvious point. So we are people who, when a baby cries, we really are motivated to help the baby because we're hardwired for that because we descend from people who were like that, whereas people who weren't like that didn't leave too many children. Let me give you another example. Right now, nobody is afraid of bathtubs. Everyone is afraid of snakes. Well, this is curious because nowadays nobody really dies from snake bite. You know, five people in the world. I don't know about Africa or South America, but in Western Europe and U.S., nobody dies from snake bite. Whereas a lot of people die from bathtubs. Bathtubs are very, very dangerous. And yet I ask my classes, well, who's afraid of a bathtub? And people look at me as if I'm crazy. And I say, who's afraid of snakes? And everybody says, yeah, they're afraid of snakes. Why? Well, sociobiology says that a million years ago, whenever we were in trees or caves, there was no competitive or comparative advantage in being afraid of bathtubs. You didn't leave more children to the next generation if you were afraid of bathtubs. But if you weren't afraid of snakes, you didn't leave too many children to the next generation. I mean, if you went up and patted a snake and said, here, snakey, snakey, you pretty much died. So we're hardwired to be afraid of snakes in a way that we're not hardwired at all to be afraid of bathtubs. And yet, as I say, bathtubs kill a lot of people. Milton Friedman died from a bathtub. He was like 93, and he slipped in a bathtub, and he hit his head, and on the way to the hospital, he passed away.
Hmm.
Okay, so what is all this got to do with the price of whatever? What this has got to do with why we're hardwired towards socialism is there are two ways that we can cooperate with each other, and if we don't cooperate with each other, we die. For example, if in our tribe, if you're sick this week, I help you. Next week I'm sick, you help me. Our tribe prospers. In the other tribe, if you're sick this week, I say the hell with you. Next week I'm sick, you say the hell with me. Our tribe doesn't lead too many children. So that would be a third example. Well, there are two ways we can cooperate with each other. One is explicitly. I'm sick, you help me. You're sick, I help you. That's explicit. And we are hardwired for that. We have benevolence. Even though the U.S. is a welfare state, we still give charity. If you and I are walking down the street and we see somebody drowning or unconscious, we will, if we're professionals, we'll help them. And if not, we'll call an ambulance. Or if we can swim, we'll swim in and save the drowning person. And if you do that, you're considered heroic. And if you can throw them a rope, this is a good thing, and we would all be inclined to do that. We're hardwired to be benevolent. We're hardwired for explicit cooperation. But in a world of 7 billion people, you can't really run an economy based on explicit cooperation. You can't really run it on the basis of benevolence and charity. You have to run it on the basis of implicit cooperation. Now, what's implicit cooperation? Implicit cooperation is the market. It's implicit cooperation is the free enterprise system. So we're not hardwired to accept that because a million years ago we didn't have much markets, whereas benevolence is very important. Let me give you an example of that, a dramatic example that makes this point. We had Katrina in New Orleans, which was a storm that wiped out all sorts of stuff. And what happened was price gouging, or to be non-pejorative about it, the prices of all sorts of things rose because you just couldn't deliver them to New Orleans. The price of milk and orange juice and baby diapers and candles and flashlight batteries, they all rose. Now, you and I are sophisticated economists. We have overcome our hardwired hatred for the market, and we realize the benevolent benefits of price rises, and there are two. One of them is in terms of allocation of goods. If the prices stay the way they were, and we all rush into the Walmart, the first 100 people are going to buy up everything. At the old prices of orange juice, they're going to take 20 gallons of orange juice or water or ice cubes or whatever it is. But if the prices go up tenfold, then we will all act in a way that is more benevolent. We'll leave some stuff in Walmart or the supermarket for the people in the back of the line. So that's one benefit of a high price rise. The other benefit is, in 2005 during Katrina, the people in California or the people in Canada or the people in Mexico had two motivations to help us. One was benevolence, and that was working, except for FEMA, which would stop them, but that's the whole other
thing. Oh, yeah.
The other one is to make profits. And if the prices rise tenfold in New Orleans, then you have two motivations helping the New Orleanians. One, ordinary benevolence, and the other, the desire to make a profit. But if you pass a law, as Governor Blanco then did in Louisiana, saying that price gougers will be jailed or shot or whatever it was, well, now you take away one of the motivations. And the people in New Orleans, foolishly, because they're hardwired against implicit cooperation, applauded her. They said, yes, yes, price gouging is evil. We can't have it. So that's my explanation of why libertarianism is sort of like pushing the rock of Sisyphus up the mountain. It keeps rolling down. Hmm. Why the libertarian movement gets 1% of the vote. Why Ron Paul isn't president, and you got this moron jerk Obama. And if you didn't have Obama, you would have had the moron jerk, what's his name, Mitt Romney. And before you had Bush, they're all horrible people, equally horrible. I don't see much difference between them.
Yeah.
Actually, I favored Obama over Romney because I thought he'd be a little bit better on foreign policy, although equally horrible on economic policy. But the point I'm trying to make is the reason we have such a difficulty in getting this idea across is because of biology. People are hardwired. They don't want to hear it. They can't hear it. They're hardwired not to hear it because it didn't help very much a million years ago to be open to markets. So we, a few libertarian Austrian types who are open to this, have overcome our biological predisposition to be against free enterprise and to be against liberty. That's why was having such a trouble getting the idea across. That's why I don't know how many people in Sweden are going to listen to this, but I imagine a few hundred, maybe a few thousand. Whereas when Obama speaks, or the Prime Minister of Sweden speaks, you get millions listening. That's why.
Yeah.
Because of biology.
Now, a free enterprise system, a capitalist free market system, has that been in place, in your view, anywhere in the last, I don't know, 50 years? I mean, what's unfolded lately, you know, and again, if we put focus on the U.S., that many people put the blame for what has happened, you know, with the financial situation and everything else, that this is capitalism is to blame for this. This is run amok capitalism, right? There's been a number of this is in the mainstream media all the time now, of course, that this is where the fault is. And so many people are obviously looking away from that. But in your view, Walter, has there been a free enterprise system in place really for, I don't know, over 100 years? I guess it would be one that was in place at some point in the U.S. early in the process of the country, correct? But what would it be today if we would define it? What system is it that you have?
Well, I think we have crony capitalism or fascism. I don't think we have laissez-faire capitalism. The U.S. Was very free in 200 years ago, except for one minor detail, and I'm being sarcastic here. Slavery is a little incompatible with
free enterprise. Sure, yep.
But we do have free enterprise in the interstices of the economy. For example, there's no paperclip problem. There's no rubber band problem. There's no, problem of shoelaces. And the reason for that is that we have free enterprise in those areas, or at least very little government regulation, very little government control. Whereas in Venezuela, with this socialist situation there, they're having toilet paper problems. They can't get enough toilet paper, which was very similar to what happened in the USSR. Well, the USSR was having the same problems that Venezuela is now having, and Venezuela is blaming greed or capitalism on lack of toilet paper. The reason is that they have heavy controls. I mean, if there were a toilet paper shortage, the prices of toilet paper would go up, the profits in toilet paper would go up, and the entrepreneurs would start producing it. So that's why you don't have problems with paper clips or rubber bands or shoelaces or things like that, because the heavy hand of the government is not really too involved in those things. You have much more problem in banking and the areas under control, automobiles, housing, things like that, because the government is much more in control there. My analysis is we don't really have laissez-faire capitalism except for these relatively unimportant things. And by the way, if you have to have government intervention, let's not have it in important things like housing or medicine or healthcare. Let's screw up paper clips or rubber bands or something like that. If you have to have government do that. Now, my analysis of the financial crisis that we're now in the midst of, it's got nothing to do with laissez-faire capitalism. It's got to do with crony capitalism or fascism. A lot of people think that if you have fascism, it's because you have to have jackboots, and you have to have stupid songs, and you have to have a swastika. That might be political fascism, but economic fascism is pretty much what we have in the U.S. and I think in most Western European countries. Obama is much more of a fascist than a socialist. The economic definition of socialist is government ownership of the means of production, the heavy industries. Mm. The only really socialist thing that he's done is with medicine and with automobiles, taking over Detroit. The rest of it is much more fascism, which, technically speaking, as I say, got nothing to do with goose-stepping. It's got to do with government regulation. So we have all sorts of government regulation, and banking is one of the most heavily regulated industries of all. So it should be no accident that banking would be the source of many of our problems. Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, myself, and all free market people favor free market money, not currency of like the euro or any of those other currencies, which are statist kinds of things.
Yeah.
We have a financial crisis, and we have the government fiat currency, and everyone's blaming the free market. Well, yeah, I mean, that's crazy. If we had really a free market, we would have a free market money. Now, how do you get free market money? The way you get free market money is, first, you have to look back at as to how money is created in the first place. Remember at the very opening of our session, I said we're going to trade, corn for milk?
Yeah.
Well, the problem with barter is that it's inefficient. Because suppose I have a chicken and I want pickles. Then I have to find someone who has pickles and wants chickens. It's called in economics the double coincidence of wants, and this is would be a great coincidence if I could find someone who had what I wanted and wanted what I have. Usually you don't get that. Usually the people who want what you have don't want they don't have what you want. So we have a thing called an intermediary or an intermediation. So, for example, let's say corn. Everyone wants corn. So if I have a chicken and I want pickles, I don't go and try to find someone who's got a pickle and wants chickens. What I do is I trade in my chicken for corn. And then I go to somebody who's got pickles and I say, hey, give me some pickles, here's corn. And he'll accept it because then he can take the corn and turn it around for something that he wants, say a bicycle. And then the bicycle guy can take the corn and buy what he wants, say a Frisbee or who knows. So we have this intermediate goods, call it corn. Well, many goods have been trying to be intermediate goods. Corn is one of them, perhaps, although I'm not sure about that. But whenever there's been free competition between goods that intermediate trade or mediate trade, facilitate trade, and if we don't have trade, we're in trouble because then we have to be masters of, jacks of all trades and masters of none. We have to be self-sufficient. We have to produce everything we need, which is pretty impossible.
Yeah.
The reason that we have 7 billion people is because, thank God, we have trade. And if we didn't have trade intermediation, we couldn't have trade. And without trade, we'd pretty much all die. So various things compete with each other as to which is the best trade intermediator. Diamonds aren't too good, even though they're very valuable, because if you try to make change in a diamond, you lose the value of it. Steel isn't too good because it's hard to break up. Cement isn't too good because it's got very heavy per value. So whenever there's been a free trade or a free market or a free enterprise, there's been one or two goods that have won out, and gold preeminently. Gold is very valuable. It's hard to fake it. Experts can tell if it's gold or not. You can make change in it. It's a soft metal, so you can break it up easily. So gold always wins out, or usually wins out, sometimes silver. And if we were going to have a free enterprise or monetary system, it would be based on gold. And initially, the pound was a pound of gold. The lira
That's right.
was a certain amount of gold. The thaler or the dollar was also a certain amount of gold. And this intermediated mediated trade very well. But governments don't like gold. Why don't governments like gold? Well, there are three ways that governments can get money. One is taxes. Problem with that is everyone knows who's doing it. You can't blame free enterprise for taxes. You can't say, well, it's Bill Gates' fault or something. I mean, everyone knows who's paying taxes. The second way is government borrows and crowds out private investment. And again, it's very easy to see who's doing the government borrowing, government. But the third way to make money for the government is inflation. And with gold, it's very hard to do it. They tried a little bit. They tried to debase the coin, you know, mix copper in with the gold or put in less precious metals, but that didn't work. Much better way is to have fiat currency, and now what they can do is either print up the dollars a while ago or make entries in fractional reserve banking. And that's the way they go. They're printing it up like drunken sailors. So the government hates gold. Gold is seen as a barbarous relic, I think it was that Keynes called it. Milton Friedman, another socialist on this issue, or another pinko, was against gold. He called people who favored gold bugs. And so to me, it's very unfair, very inaccurate to blame free enterprise for our present housing or financial crisis when we don't have a free enterprise system. If we had a free enterprise system, we'd have 100% backed dollar or Swedish kroner or whatever it is by gold. And we don't have it, so it's silly to blame the free enterprise system. This is the fault of the government. It's sort of like blaming problems of alcohol during alcohol prohibition, or blaming problems of drugs, heroin, marijuana, creating problems on the free market system when we don't have a free market system.
Very good. We are having a very interesting discussion here with Walter Block, and we have much more to talk about. This is an introduction, of course, to some of these topics, and we'll continue to talk more about this after a short break here. But I want to give out your website, Walter. I want to make sure people know where to go to read more about you. And please go ahead and mention some of your book titles as well, so people know where to or what titles to pick up, rather.
Well, my website is walterblock.com. I've written on and about 20, 25 books. My most recent ones are in 2012, Yes to Ron Paul and Liberty, sort of my love letter to Ron Paul. I've got The Case of Discrimination, Racial and Sexual Discrimination, which is very non-controversial. I'm kidding. I've got a book, Privatizing the Highways, came out in 2009. I've got Labor Economics, 2008. Perhaps my most famous book is Defending the Undefendable, which came out in 1976 and is still selling copies. Some of these books are for free. Defending the Undefendable is for free, although I refuse to sign it electronically. You have to buy one if you want my signature on it. I also would like to put in a plug for my university, Loyola University New Orleans, where all of my colleagues, which is very rare, all five out of the five of us are free enterprises. And I'd also like to put in a plug for my favorite institution, the Mises Institute, which is located in Auburn, Alabama, and has every book known to man and some not known to man on its web, and that is of a free market variety. And the bad guys, too, and has conferences and media and all sorts of contributions to liberty. So if you enjoy my discussion, these would be ways to follow up on what I've been doing.
Very good. WalterBlock.com and Mises.org. We'll have these linked up there as well. You can write a little bit now and then for Lou Rockwell as well, .com. I know that. Very good. We're going to continue to talk more about all this. We'll be back after a short break, so stay with us.
Thank you.
right, guys, we'll proceed with Walter Block in the second hour at redicemembers.com. Go there to log in or sign up for a membership if you haven't already, and continue to listen to this or any of our 700-plus programs that we have for you in our archives. We'll proceed to talk about security, safety, and liberty. Walter comments on the latest NSA debacle and privacy issues. We'll discuss anarchist writer Lysander Spooner, and Walter talks more about Murray Rothbard and egalitarianism as a myth and as a revolt against nature. Before we proceed with Walter in the second, I just want to let you know about some of our upcoming guests. Allison Adams on mouth-body health, toxic dentistry, and a natural recovery plan. After this, we have Alan Abadesa with Douglas Bowles and William Klaus on the Sync Book Volume 2. Later, we have an update from Patrick Henningsen from 21st Century Wire, and Radio 314 will have the guys from Joy Camp coming on. RedIceMembers.com. That is the website. We'll talk to you and Walter Block there.